Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A lot of what Ben Bernanke says is confusing enough to begin with. Today, the Fed chairman changed things up a little bit, though, testifying to Republicans in Congress. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 9th of February today. And Ben Bernanke made another of his semi-regular schleps up to Capitol Hill this morning. It was at the invitation of the House Budget Committee, chaired for the first time by Representative Paul Ryan. If this was television, this would be where you'd see a little letter R and Wisconsin by Ryan's name, because today's hearing was a meet and greet of sorts with the new majority in the House, some of whom are none too enamored of Mr. Bernanke and his $600 billion worth of bond buying. The Fed chairman didn't back down at all, but Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains he did recalibrate his message ever so slightly.
When the nation's top banker speaks to Congress, it's like he's on stage at a music hall, but he's singing a different tune to each section, the orchestra, the cheap seats, and the balcony. Bill Frenzel sat in the fiscal conservative section in the 80s and 90s as top-ranking Republican on the House Budget Committee.
Any good Fed chairman often talks in Delphic tones, and they are understood differently by different people.
So let's take apart one of these Bernanke-isms to see what he's saying and to whom.
Even after economic and financial conditions return to normal, the federal budget will remain on an unsustainable path.
That first part about economic conditions returning to normal, that's a defense of current Fed policy, keeping money cheap and plentiful. Brian Bethune at IHS Global Insight says Bernanke's signaling his resolve that the Fed will keep sustaining the recovery.
Even though the Fed is more upbeat, what Bernanke is trying to say is we don't want to make the mistake of withdrawing the monetary stimulus too early.
Then Bernanke turns to the fiscal hawks and sings them a tune.
The federal budget will remain on an unsustainable path unless the Congress enacts significant changes in fiscal programs.
That's a call out to all those new Republicans in the audience, says Frenzel.
You guys got to start pulling your share of the burden, too, in the Congress to inflict some fiscal sobriety.
Here, Bernanke's message is to focus on long-term fiscal problems like health care spending and Social Security. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Picking up on that bit about the budget being on an unsustainable path, President Obama releases his budget next week. Spending is out. Austerity is in, for the most part. The White House plan is said to include a provision to help states keep on paying unemployment benefits. Might be nice for now, but might be trouble down the line, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Employers pay state and federal taxes to fund unemployment benefits, but this recession, states borrowed from the federal government to come up with enough money. Now they have to pay back the loans. The Obama budget would delay those payments for 2 years, and after that, state governments could double the tax on employers to build up their insurance funds. Gary Bertlis at the Brookings Institution says with 9% unemployment, delaying the pain is the right trade-off.
It doesn't seem like a good time to increase the tax penalty on employers when they add someone to their payroll.
The president's budget idea is similar to what the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities recommended today. The center proposes to forego state unemployment reimbursements for 2 years, but to gradually raise the taxes on employers to pay for unemployment insurance. The center's Iris Laff says states are in a tough spot.
In this recession, they have to pay back those funds that they borrowed, and they have to prepare for the next recession so they won't just be borrowing continuously. In order to do that, somewhere, somehow, tax rates have to go up.
But there's no guarantee things will be better in 2 years, says Gary Bertlis.
If the economy is still in the tank, the president who holds office then can make the same recommendation to defer for another couple of years.
That would only increase federal deficits. Eventually, he says, revenues have to come in to keep unemployment benefits flowing. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a bumpy, if not a big, ride. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tens of thousands of Egyptians took to the streets once again today. It wasn't just political protests in Cairo today either. Labor unions were out on strike in other parts of the country as well. And across the region, from Tunisia to Egypt and over to Jordan, people are demanding change. They want political change, obviously, but they also want economic change. They want a chance at prosperity and an end to the wealthy elites who they believe are sucking their countries dry. From Amman, Jordan, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Traffic in the streets of this capital has been unusually light since the unrest in Tunisia and Egypt began. Jordanians have been rushing home early to watch the unfolding events on TV. Jordan has been mesmerized. Oraib al-Rantawi, a political commentator, says most of the Arab world's been infused with a new spirit.
We are living in the Tunisian, the Egyptian moment. This is the spirit. Nobody will stop it.
It is, he says, a spirit of rebellion against state-sponsored theft. Across the Middle East, many people believe their autocratic leaders have been robbing them blind.
When you don't have democracy, you have no accountability, no transparency, and then you have corruption.
That's Jordanian businessman Labib Kamhawi. He says that like most Middle Eastern countries, Jordan is run by a clique of wealthy families and individuals, politicians in cahoots with business people. Kamhawi says many of them plunder the public purse, hog the best jobs, and try to skim a bit off every government contract.
The corruption really covers all aspects of life, which left people who don't belong to this class helpless.
Not everyone agrees that Jordan is a hotbed of corruption. Local economist Yusuf Mansour.
There is corruption. There is corruption. However, as an economist, I don't see it as massive or widely spread as in other countries.
That does not reassure critics of the system. One of them claims there's an unofficial poverty line for corrupt individuals. If they don't manage to rip off more than $50 million during their careers, they're not doing well. But Jordan is an undemocratic monarchy. King Abdullah hires and fires his governments. Critics like Labib Kamhawi do have a question to answer. Is the king and his family profiting personally from this corruption?
The law punishes anybody who talks about the king or the royal family. So we cannot talk. You ask the king. You don't ask me.
The king declined our invitation to appear on this program. But one expatriate Jordanian journalist is not so reticent. He's been circulating over the internet an open letter addressed to Queen Rania.
What gives you the right to celebrate your birthday with a party costing $15 million? And for the king to give you a yacht costing $83 million? In a poor country that has no oil, lives off aid, and cannot buy milk for its children?
Around half the Jordanian population lives on less or little more than $2.50 a day. In Amman, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Back to Egypt now for a bit. While that country's economy is coming very slowly back to life as people get accustomed to near constant protests, one person who is certainly not hurting economically is the man the protests are directed against. Depending on what you read, Hosni Mubarak is worth many, many millions, quite possibly billions of dollars. Christopher Davidson is a professor of Middle East politics at Durham University in England. Professor Davidson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Is there an easy and accessible way to figure out how much Hosni Mubarak is worth?
No, absolutely not. All of the figures we've seen in the press over the last week are speculation, admittedly some educated guesses along the way. I would have thought that if we had been able to have some proper investigation and come up with a figure, then the very highly paid and very smart people who have been employed by the Mubarak family to secrete and store the wealth overseas won't have done their job.
Well, however much he has then, how did he get it?
Well, I think this is, if you excuse the expression, a pyramid of wealth that's been built up over the years. Of course, Mubarak began his time and influence as a military man before he even became president, of course. Back then, it seems a lot of deals, both with the West and the Soviet Union, kickbacks on many of these contracts that were signed, kickbacks all the way up to the top. Much of that wealth seems to have been invested overseas. A traditional way to store this wealth for many Arab elites is to put it in mature Western real estate, in particular in London and the United States. And the indications are that Mubarak has done exactly that. Alongside all of that real estate investment, there will be the good old numbered bank accounts, most likely in Switzerland too.
Has he turned this into family wealth for his spouse and his children?
Well, that seems to be part of the tension at the moment in Egypt, that it's not so much Mubarak himself, who's been fairly discreet over the years, and after all, he's a military man by background. It rather seems to perhaps be his wife and his sons who've been a little bit more ostentatious with their wealth, and the sons in particular have built up these business empires.
You know, it's not as easy as it used to be for dictators to fade into posterity with their bank accounts intact. If President Mubarak eventually does go, does his money go with him, or will it be able to be recouped in some way?
Well, I think given the recent ruling, the former Haiti dictator, Baby Doc, he's not getting his hands on his Swiss bank accounts, and that's being returned to the legitimate government of Haiti. I'm sure that Mubarak is well aware of this in Egypt. I'm sure at the moment Mubarak is doing everything he can to move things around wherever it is in the world so that he can get his hands on it if he needs to leave. Another way of perhaps looking at this is that he cannot afford to be just ousted, because then he's no longer seen as a legitimate president who stepped down. So he does need to leave gracefully, and this may explain some of the delays in Egypt at the moment.
I imagine if you go down into Tahrir Square and talk to some of those protesters, they don't care about the money. They just want him gone.
I think they want him gone. I think, though, that as it becomes increasingly clear that Mubarak and his genre in the Middle East have very much been accumulating this wealth, I think there will be cries to have some of this repatriated to the country, especially given that Egypt, like Yemen, Tunisia, etc., all have fairly low GDP per capitas and quite a chunk of the population living below the poverty line.
Christopher Davidson, he's a professor of Middle East politics at Durham University over in England. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. You're welcome.
We'll have some more tomorrow from our Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio on what's being done to stop dictators from cashing in when they're deposed. And we'll go back to Jordan to see what life is like there for those on the other end of the power and money continuum. And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials bumped up 6 points on this Wednesday, almost 0.1%, finished at 12,239. The NASDAQ off 7 points, 0.25%, closed at 2,789. The S&P 500 shaved off 3 points. It's about 0.25%, finished at 1,320. Wells Fargo cashed out 2.8% today after its chief financial officer abruptly retired. Morgan Stanley lost 1.8%. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan Chase all lost more than 1% today. Bank of America, though, rose 0.2%. Some earnings news was good. Walt Disney raised up 5.25% today on news that ESPN advertising revenues have grown. Ralph Lauren, or Ralph Lauren, somebody write in and correct me, donned an 8% gain today. Coca-Cola floated up nearly 0.5% after strong quarterly profits. Computer Sciences Corporation unplugged 14% today. The tech outsourcing and consulting firm reported lower than expected revenue, said fewer government contracts were coming through. And you are listening. Wait, what's the name of the show? Oh, yeah, Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. By Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Reputation.com, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Treasury Department releases the federal budget for January. The House Ways and Means Committee examines what impact the health care overhaul will have on Medicare and Medicare beneficiaries. And the Federal Aviation Administration concludes its annual Commercial Space Transportation Conference. Hey, When can I get a martini on Mars? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama had the top three Republicans in the House over for lunch today. I have no idea what they ate, but the conversation was probably more interesting anyway. It was probably about where they might be able to find common ground and where they'll agree to disagree. Healthcare reform is distinctly in that latter category. But commentator Robert Reich says sometimes you just gotta eat your vegetables.
The Republican vote to repeal the new healthcare law is purely symbolic. Besides, polls show most of the public continues to support the health care law, especially the requirement that insurers cover people with pre-existing conditions and don't drop someone with a costly disease. But there's one provision of the law that Republicans are likely to try to defund, and they may have the public with them on this. It's the so-called individual mandate, the requirement that everyone purchase health insurance or pay a fine. According to a recent poll, 60% of the public opposes it. They just don't like the idea of government telling them they have to buy something. The mandate is also particularly vulnerable to legal challenge. So far, two federal judges, one in Virginia and another in Florida, have struck it down. They say the federal government has no more constitutional authority requiring citizens to buy insurance than requiring them to buy and consume broccoli or asparagus. The Florida judge referred to broccoli. The Virginia judge, to asparagus. Yet the new system can't work without the individual mandate. Only if everyone buys insurance can insurers afford to cover people with pre-existing conditions or pay the costs of catastrophic diseases. The curious thing is Americans don't mind individual mandates when they come in the form of payroll taxes to buy mandatory public insurance. In fact, that's the system we call Social Security and Medicare. And both are so popular, politicians dare not touch them. And no federal judge has struck down Social Security or Medicare as being unconstitutional requirements that Americans buy something. Social Security and Medicare aren't broccoli or asparagus. They're as American as hot dogs and apple pie. So if the individual mandate to buy private health insurance gets struck down by the Supreme Court or killed off by Congress, I'd recommend President Obama immediately propose what he should have proposed at the beginning, universal health care based on Medicare for all, financed through payroll taxes.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. David Frum is back next week. In the meanwhile, send along your comments, marketplace.org. As you know, click on the link that says contact. Do you have a green team at the office, the people who take away all the styrofoam cups and paper plates and tell you to bring your own darn china and silverware? We had a certain transition period, shall we say, when that happened here at Marketplace. The office products company Staples has what it hopes will be a profitable alternative, selling recycled or compostable stuff directly to companies, not consumers. Eve Tro reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
When a major company like Staples launches a new business-to-business line like this, it's never out of the blue. Carrie Krasinski works for Trucost, a firm that helps businesses measure their impact on the environment. He says Staples is responding to huge corporations that have announced their plans to cut waste and carbon pollution.
It's a kind of a domino effect, actually. They're going to be holding their suppliers to account for their sustainability.
Staples likely wants to be on good terms with companies like Walmart and Procter & Gamble that have made environmental commitments. Its Sustainable Earth line now offers things like compostable forks and napkins with recycled paper. Those can help companies meet their green goals. Krasinski says it's a proactive move by Staples because suppliers that don't have green products may find themselves in sticky conversations.
When you're called by, say, IBM or one of your numerous other corporate clients, they might wonder why you aren't doing something like this.
In terms of impact, things like reducing factory pollution or using non-toxic chemicals are usually more important than recycled coffee cups. But business consultant Deborah Fleischer says companies that go green also want visible efforts. That gets employees on board.
Wow, we're using recycled things in the break room, we're using recycled things in the bathrooms. I think it just makes them feel like the company's actually walking the talk.
And she says feeling green is an important part of ingraining sustainability into corporate culture. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
First up in letters today, my interview yesterday with Kate Betts about Michelle Obama and the power of her style. John Welch from Santa Cruz, California, wrote to say that we should be looking at the substance of Michelle Obama's work, like her anti-obesity campaign, not just her style. Valencia Wood of Ellicott City, Maryland, says Mrs. Obama would probably want to recognize African-American fashion icons that came before her as well.
Such as Beverly Johnson, Kamora Lee Simmons, Diane Carroll, Mrs. Eunice Johnson, the creator of Ebony Fashion Fair, and Naomi Sims.
Our post-Super Bowl commentary on Monday about what might happen if there's a lockout in the NFL later this year brought William Davidson of Nashville, Tennessee, to the phone. He didn't much care for our jab at the Detroit Lions and how no NFL season would mean the generally subpar Lions wouldn't lose any games. Let's, Mr. Davidson says, just examine the evidence from the season just past, shall we?
For example, the December 12th game in which the Lions beat the Packers, or the next game, a win over Tampa Bay, or the next win over Miami, or the final game of the season, a win over the Vikings. But hey, don't let reality stand in the way of a stale, calcified insult.
Speaking of insults, here's one that we, the media, that is, are to blame for people having reached their limits on stories about global warming. That was Stephanie Kaufman's reaction to our piece this week about how environmentalists are just trying to get people to care.
Instead of talking about what people do care about and what they are doing to effectuate change, they're talking about how people don't care and that there's this sense of apathy. And I think the sense of apathy comes from the fact that there's nothing being done about it by our government or in the media. It hasn't been the issue that it needs to be.
We heard from Dr. John Carroll about that story as well. He practices in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he figures we ought to think about planetary health the same way we think about our own health.
I find that people are more likely to be motivated to address their diabetes when we talk about how they will immediately feel better. The same principle likely applies in the discussion of environment. We can focus on the positive short-term benefits of environmental initiatives, knowing that the long-term benefits come along for the ride.
We'd feel a whole lot better if you wrote in to tell us how we're doing. Just go to our website, marketplace.org, as you know. You can find links there to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter as well. The Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan is, as you may know, an economically interesting place. Doesn't have much use for traditional measures of progress. It tracks gross national happiness, not gross domestic product. Until 40-odd years ago, didn't have any paved roads. Even now, a quarter of its population doesn't live anywhere near a road, paved or otherwise. But they'd like to. So over the past couple of years, Bhutan's first democratically elected parliament has been making good on a promise to build roads to the most remote of mountain villages. Lisa Napoli explores how a single smoothed-out strip of dirt has changed life for residents of one village in eastern Bhutan.
For centuries, to get to the village of Chali, people had to trek several miles up a steep mountain path. A tiny hamlet of 2,300, Chali's main landmark is a 14th-century Buddhist temple. But about 6 months ago, a new sound started to compete with these sacred prayer wheels. Trucks and cars. Government officials cut a dirt road into the side of the mountain. It's bumpy and winding and no wider than an SUV. But it's given Chali an economic boost. It's much easier now to get basic supplies to the village. Ugun Norbu is the district administrator of Chali. He says now people don't have to walk like they used to.
Originally, they had to carry everything on their backs. Now they drive it here.
Miles from the village, in the valley below, Chali residents can now sell their abundant produce at a small farm stand. Instead of lugging it down the mountain, they pool resources and hire a car. An elderly woman named Chuki is peddling lemons and squash.
I'm old now. The road makes it more comfortable.
The road to Chali is part of more than 100 miles that have been graded for vehicle traffic in this district alone. All around Bhutan, the government's trying to stem the tide of migration from rural areas to towns by making life easier and more prosperous in the villages. Chali, Mayor Sonam Sirang says the mobility the road allows has certainly been a boon to his people.
There's been improvement after the road. People are getting richer every day, 100% better day by day.
District Administrator Ugun Norbu says it's not just financial. The more people who visit the village and the more the villagers can travel, the broader their thinking will be. For himself, the first thing he did when the road was finished was to get a friend with a car to drive up and bring him a television. From Chali, Bhutan, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Lisa first went to Bhutan while she was working here. She did used to be a reporter for her. She came across Chali in her travels through the more remote parts of that country. You can see a video of the village, and an excerpt from her new book, Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. It's all on our new book blog, marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a couple of them actually, one substantive, one a little more tongue-in-cheek. First of all, the stocks to be in today on the major exchanges were exchange stocks. Seriously, there's all kinds of talk of mergers and acquisitions. The London Stock Exchange is buying the Canadian market operator TMX, and NYSE Euronext, that's the New York Stock Exchange, is said to be in advanced talks about being bought by Deutsche Börse from over in Germany. NYSE shares today up 17%. Also up, nose jobs. From the Marketplace desk, if I am honestly not making this up, an increase in cosmetic surgeries is seen as a positive economic indicator. And sure enough, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons says pent-up demand sent the number of procedures up 5% last year. First increase since 2007. So there you go. We report, you decide. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 6 points, almost a 10%. The NASDAQ dropped 7 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 shaved off 3 points. That's about 0.25% as well. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Cologne, Bradford Craig, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, clawbacks and the bad guys.
The dictator is deposed. The new people who come in definitely have a very strong legal hand to go after him and go after his assets.
Our series, Economy 4.0, returns. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.